And welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Tonight we have two shows coming up. We'll start off with Albums Without Borders and then move on to What Are You Up To? Enjoy!
Welcome back to AUP Radio. This is Albums Without Borders. I am George, and I'm here with my co-host, Andrew. This week, we will be talking about LCD Sound System's 2010 album, This Is Happening. How have you been this week, Andrew?
I've been good. I've been okay. You know, I go to college.
Yeah, we do both go to this college. We do. We try, at least.
Yeah.
Losing momentum here toward the end of the semester. Everybody's tired. You can feel it. And ironically, it's not slowing down, speeding up. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
You've been listening to anything interesting this week apart from LCD Sound System?
Fountains of Wayne.
Fountains every time. Every damn time.
Really like Fountains of Wayne.
Yeah, I know. I'm aware.
Yeah.
I really didn't listen to much apart from LCD Sound System because I was not very familiar with them. I kind of just knew the one song, and which is Dance Yourself Clean. And so it took me a little bit to get into them. Not something I'm really familiar with in terms of production style. And the first listen was not that easy, I'm not going to lie.
Was it a little rough?
It was a little rough. Yeah. I mean, I could tell they were talented from the get-go, but it was just not what I'm used to. And then, you know, once I did some research, got some context to the album and what James Murphy, the front man, was trying to do, who he is, where he's from, that helped a lot. That helped me.
I have some information for you. You probably know all this information, but for our listeners.
I mean, try me. Let's do it.
So, James Murphy, he was born in Princeton Junction, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I'm only mentioning this because I'm also from New Jersey. I'm really proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
And on his latest release, sort of as the band was doing their last tour, because James Murphy actually retired from rock stardom. He went on the Stephen Colbert Show and did an interview about it. And Colbert basically asked him, rock stars don't usually walk away from the groupies are a much lower quality. They're, you know, and he answered, I have some things I want to do. I like making coffee. He's a weird dude.
He is definitely a weird dude.
He's a very strange guy. And the album cover for that live album, Live from Madison Square Garden, is actually in the shape of New Jersey. Or at least I adamantly argue so with my friends, and some people don't see it. Maybe you could look it up while we're talking.
Yeah, I'm going to find it.
So, at the age of 22, James Murphy was offered a job on the sitcom Seinfeld, which was then little known. He did not expect the show to be successful and chose to continue with music. So, that probably was one of the biggest what-ifs in history, because he was a writer. He was an English major at NYU. He didn't graduate from it. He dropped out because, you know, he wanted to be a rock star. And when he was 26, there's an interview with him that's pretty widely available, and he basically describes how he felt like a failure when he was 26 years old. He felt like that was a little bit too old to be doing nothing
with
his life.
Yeah, it was cool.
He felt like he wasn't really good at his life, mm-hmm. whatever that means. And he talked about, as you probably heard, David Foster Wallace, my favorite author. He released the instant classic novel Infinite Jest, and in the interview he basically says, he believed that if he put his life on hold for the next 5 years, and he was an English major, he's interested in writing, and that I think that shows pretty transparently in the way that he writes his lyrics for his songs. He felt like he couldn't finish that. He couldn't do something of the same merit if he started right now. He was 26 and Wallace was 31 when he wrote Infinite Jest, which is incredibly young to write one of the most influential novels of the 90s. So, you know, it's a little bit unfair to compare yourself to David Foster Wallace. It's like the literary equivalent of being a computer scientist, comparing yourself to Elon Musk, I feel like. And he sort of became dreadful because of that fact. I mean, it was really weird because he hated himself, but also at the same time, it's pretty clear that he saw himself as having the ability, if he really tried, to become a David Foster Wallace. He felt like, you know, he wasn't any smarter than he was, or he wasn't as talented as he was, or creative as he was. And I feel like this album is pretty relevant in terms of comparing it or juxtaposing it with Infinite Jest, because it is sort of the magnum opus of James Murphy's career, and it looks to remain that way. He's kind of old now, and he's not in his creative peak, and he's mostly working on, like, I saw this interesting New York Times video about James Murphy where he's working on making the New York City subway sound much more pleasant at the gate, where you insert the card and you try to make it musical. Like every time that a person tries to go through one of the terminals, it would make like a musical note. And if a bunch of people are during rush hour, they're traveling through the station, it would create sort of like a harmonic scale instead of the current sound that the New York City subway makes when you enter the subway. It's like a loud, high-pitched beep. It's not pleasant at all. So he's working on stuff like that. He's a very eccentric guy.
Yeah.
You know. So this album was recorded in a place called The Mansion.
Yeah, I've heard of The Mansion. That's where Rick Rubin.
Yeah.
He's a record producer. He hosts a lot of recordings there, yeah. And he's had some pretty established albums recorded there, and established musicians do their stuff there. Recently, Ed Lord, I think, did some Spotify sessions. Back in the day, you had Red Hot Chili Peppers doing their Sex Magik album.
Yeah.
Jay-Z did a song there.
Guns N' Roses.
Guns N' Roses. Yeah. No, so it must be pretty cool. And I watched the video you sent me with the making of LCD Sound Systems. This is happening, the album we're doing. And it's cool to watch them kind of, you know, stress out about the music. There's a bit where he's doing laundry, and it kind of makes it makes the whole process seem more real, as opposed to all right, this is what the studio wants us to record, we're here, we're the talent, let's record it and leave. They were there and actually kind of figuring it all out as they were going. They brought a lot of their own stuff. They were playing badminton in the pool, which they called Goodminton, which is hilarious because they weren't trying to score any points.
Yeah, he said it goes from like Goodminton to pretty Goodminton excellent Minton.
Exactly, there's levels to it. And he said they invented it in Ibiza on MDMA, which was pretty funny.
But it was mostly just like having fun with friends, because they were playing in the dark in the video, and they're like champagne break, and everyone's drinking champagne in the pool. It's a bunch of like millionaires, or at least one millionaire in presence. It was really cool. I mean, I sent you that video because that really hit home for me that this album was coming from a very particular place for James Murphy and for all the other crew. There's a few musicians that are with LCD Sound System that have continually been with them, at least up to the point where they released American Dream with the track Oh Baby on it, which I think is pretty good. You're a fan of sports, George, right? You like sports quite a bit.
Generally,
and
yeah.
In basketball, at the very least, I believe that the team takes on the personality of the most talented player on the team. And this is very much true in a LCD Sound System's case. And I say team as an example because most bands are not run like sports teams. But in the video, it seemed like he was trying to encourage all these other musicians that are friends of his, in this really like homey, sort of comfortable, but also like incubator-like. It's mainly an incubator, right? It's like sort of like
very much so.
Yeah, it was like a dorm room. It seemed like.
Yeah.
And I think that obviously you need to contextualize it with their other albums, with Losing My Edge, their first album, the eponymous album that's named just LCD Sound System, which has a lot of great tracks on it, like Daft Punk is playing at my house, and then the second album, Sound of Silver, which is one of the best. It's one of my favorite albums. and but this album is particularly different from those two, more than American Dream is, in my opinion, because it has a certain kind of sincere edge to it. It's still edgy, and it's still very much punk electronica. I don't know how to describe it.
No,
but
that's a good way to describe it.
Punk electronica.
Lyrically, they do some weird poetry stuff, some stuff that might even be in, I don't know, ska music and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But production-wise, it is inescapably electronic for sure. They have... They're known as a rock band, and they have plenty of elements of rock in it. You know, he plays guitar, and but through the back of it, he's got very funky keyboard and synthesizers and stuff going on, and that's what jostled me at first listen. It's not something, not a production style I'm used to listening to, and not something I'd seek out usually. But once I got through past that, I was able to actually quite appreciate the album.
I really want to get to that. I think that's the most interesting part of this conversation. But I first want to say that James Murphy is an interesting character to me, at least as a rock star. I don't know if I can categorize him as a rock star, and I'll explain why. The reason why is because he's not like Lou Reed or Bob Dylan or John Lennon. He's closer to Paul McCartney, in the sense that Lou Reed's troubles are very much like he's a tortured artist. He's severely depressed, and he's got a lot of messed up stuff going on in his brain, and he writes from that perspective, whereas James Murphy is writing from the perspective that we all have, especially as college students, as these, I would have to say that we have pretty, respectable identities as university students. I think by default, I think the university program is a great place for people to make friends in a near-perfect environment. It's where you learn stuff, besides a prize. James Murphy felt like he was not succeeding. It wasn't like he was writing from a place where, like John Lennon writes from, where he has an experience that is singular to himself. It's like no one else has a life of John Lennon, but James Murphy feels a sense of failure when he's not achieving the things that everyone told him he should be achieving. Mm. And I feel like you can relate to that somewhat. I can relate to that definitely.
For sure.
Because every moment that I'm not really doing something, because I'm paying a lot of money to go to this college, I feel like I'm continually disappointing certain people, like my parents who are paying for this. Mm. And so
he says that in one of his songs. He talks about, and it sounds like he's talking to the listener directly about how much time do you waste on average on I forget the exact lyric. But and then in the interview where he's talking about failure that you mentioned earlier, yeah, I absolutely relate to that. And I think that's what's nice about James Murphy as a celebrity, as a rock star, if you want to put it, is that he's relatable. And that's probably why you hesitate to call him a rock star, because it's like he's not intangible. You can understand the things that he goes through. You can make sense of that. I took 3 years off college and now I'm back here. So, there were times when I was working at a grocery store and I was just like, what am I doing with my life? Like, I'm getting old. I need to. So, I wasn't 26, but I also wasn't 18.
Yeah.
I definitely can relate and understand.
I think he said in an interview that's in Shut Up and Play the Hits, the documentary about The Long Goodbye, the live album that was supposed to be his last show. He says that not everyone could be David Bowie. David Bowie is like a Martian. He's coming from somewhere else that's not Earth, right? But if you want to be Lou Reed, you just wear sunglasses and not talk a lot, and you could be Lou Reed, which I thought was really funny because it's kind of true. But James Murphy is one of those guys where his persona as a rock star, if you can even call him that, is just sort of like everyone else. He's sort of like a very intelligent genius bum kind of character.
Hmm.
It's like, I don't need to try to do anything to be more like James Murphy. I feel like I'm already, I already am a regular guy, just like James Murphy is a regular guy.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine him sitting on a park bench eating a bologna sandwich in the middle of the day.
Absolutely, I could, yeah.
Thinking after he got laid off. And can you even imagine what it's like to pass up a job at Seinfeld at 22?
Mm. I mean, he didn't know what he was doing, but yeah. Literally didn't know what he was doing. He thought it wasn't going to take off, right? And
I wonder how much of his sense of failure came from the fact that he passed on that job.
Yeah. No, that's true. When I say he got successful fairly quickly, I mean it more once he actually put stuff out there, because he didn't release, Losing My Edge until he was 32 in 2002. He was born in 1970. Yeah, 1970. But yeah, no, I can see what you mean, because he obviously watched that have some success throughout the 90s, or some success, huge success throughout the 90s, before he was able to reconcile that and release some of his own art. So yeah, no, it's interesting that he might not have made some of the music he ended up making had he not been rejected by Seinfeld.
Yeah, I'm happy things turned out this way.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm sure he is too now.
So I wanted to ask your thoughts about the production of this album. Because we had a very lengthy conversation about, because you didn't like it initially.
Mm-hmm.
Could you sort of walk me through why you didn't like it initially? The squabbles that you had with the way that it sounded, you know? Because I thought that what you said was very interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to pull up my crude text to you from the other night when I was listening to it.
So you're getting an exclusive look at our private text messages.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
An insider's little sneak peek.
This is how you know we'll never be politicians.
Yeah, no, that among other things. So I think I texted you after you told me to listen to that, after you told me to listen to the album. I replied, Pow Pow is the only song that I liked. And I'll stand by that I liked that song, but I think the reason I liked that song the most out of the others was it was probably one of the easiest to follow in terms of instrumental production. The lyrics are pretty odd.
Pow.
Yeah, a lot of pow, 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 pow. But, and then I said, everything between Dance Yourself Clean and Pow Pow was underwhelming, not my vibe. But generally, I don't like the super straightforward lyricism. And then when I was researching it, James Murphy came to a lot of criticism for his lyricism of being, like, not bad, but just, like, underwhelming, like I said. People are like, wow, just not a great lyricist. But it's funny that he mentions that in one of the songs. He talks about...
bad poetry?
Yeah, the bad poetry.
Yeah,
that
it's coming from me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He's criticizing somebody else, and he's saying, that's bad poetry, but that's coming from me, as in, like, I've been criticized for my lyricism plenty, and I can even recognize that this is, like, what is this?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think the production is just a little inaccessible at first. It's not standard, and I don't know. I don't listen to just the charts and stuff, but... they had some crazy synth going on at some points. I feel like it. Occasionally he plays, not incorrectly, but like obtrusively. It's intrusive is the word I would use. Some intrusive synth comes out of nowhere and like dominates the song when you really like, I don't know, I'm not a master of production, but I would imagine it would be more of a complimentary noise in the back, if anything. And then just like, I'm sure he's making some sort of point with it. But like I said, first listen, I'm on the metro, just like eyes closed and the song starts off kind of standard, and then out of nowhere, you just get a whang, and I'm like, what is happening? What is going on? And yeah, I get the anti-establishment thing. He doesn't want to be cookie cutter, but on the first listen, it was hard to reconcile that. I was like, you gotta still sound nice, man. You still want people to enjoy what they're listening to. And it bothered me way less the second time. Like, I knew it was coming, it really wasn't quite as bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you. Listening to especially One Touch and Throw on my earphones and my AirPods, it gets a little bit, you know, what's that disease where you hear like a high pitched noise all the time?
Tinnitus.
It felt like I had tinnitus at some points.
Yeah,
I agree. But do you still feel this way about some of the production choices that he makes?
Yeah, and I think it stands out a little bit still because there are some songs on the album that are more accessible to the listener, like the last song, Home. Contrasts pretty heavily with Somebody's Calling Me, the song that precedes it. Somebody's Calling Me has pretty odd production and has those intrusive synths and crazy scales that he uses that just sound a little out of place, whereas Home, the last song, has fairly standard production. It's still a little harder for me to reconcile with the electronic, but that's the whole album. But yeah, it's a smooth listen compared to the previous song, so...
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio on World Radio Paris. Now back to Albums Without Borders.
What I would say about that is going back to something that we talked about in our first episode, where you talked about how music has this magical quality where you might be feeling sad, but music transfigures the pain. Here is a one argument rebuttal that I might say to that, that I've thought of. I think music is unique, just like other art forms, like writing is unique and painting is unique and visual design is unique, in that it has a certain frequency in which the composer's emotional state can be felt by the listener that can't really be approached by any other medium. And the reason why I bring this up is because when you're like lonely, for example, when you're sad or depressed, or when you're feeling a certain way, when you feel like you want to go out and break something, you know, that a lot of this album sounds that way. Mm-hmm. Does it sound produced and glossy when you feel this way? I feel like that what James Murphy is trying to get at with some of the production choices that might not be palatable to, so it doesn't appeal to the lowest common denominator of popular audiences, which is what a lot of movies have to do because the price of making these things are so expensive. Obviously, right. you have to appeal to desires that most people have, and on television you see physical attractiveness. A certain kind of charisma and drama and all these things.
That's what leads to the cookie cutter shape is the fact that you have to turn a profit, essentially.
Yeah.
And so I definitely have hold a place of reverence for artists like James Murphy who are successful in spite of that, that they know that they can use their intelligence and artistry that they definitely have to go do that and produce pop tracks. Like, he tried to work with Britney Spears in 2003 and it didn't work because I'm sure he was trying to push her to do some stuff that was too out there, and she was like, no, I'm, you know, former Mickey Mouse Clubhouse
star. Or her dad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. I
think it's a little bit like the Quentin Tarantino torture scene that he wanted to keep, but Harvey Weinstein didn't want to keep.
No, yeah, you're right.
It's like, yeah, like more people probably would like this movie because I know I would probably like the movie without
the torture
scene.
Reservoir Dogs, right?
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
Like, you and I, who like the movie, would probably still like the movie even without the torture scene in it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of people out there that probably don't like the movie coming out of the movie theater because there were a lot of walkouts during that scene at the Cannes Film Festival or wherever it was first shown. And that's actually what led Harvey Weinstein to say, we got to cut this out. I think that true artists are people that are entirely themselves with no compromises.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that James Murphy achieved that. Obviously not. You know, he's wildly popular and he mm-hmm. obviously has some pop sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it might be the case that this is who he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think a lot of the production choices came from this vacuum of everyone from the band being just in one place and for an extended period of time, and the album being made just bouncing around that circle.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no Swedish professor like Coldplay or Brian Eno to step inside of the studio and say, hey guys, I know you guys are trying to, you know, there's a great, great song.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a great job composing, but here's how we can tweak it to make it sound right. The best as possible. There right. wasn't anyone to do that. So James Murphy is the main production, is the main producer for this album. And, you know, we know how eccentric and particular he is.
Mm-hmm.
I think the production sort of reflects that. And yeah, it is a testament to how good he is, this, him being wildly successful despite some of the production choices.
Right, he's not fitting in, like you said. I didn't know Coldplay had
Brian Eno.
Yeah, I didn't know they had him come in and do that. But exactly, he's not. He's aware that there is a mold out there that you can squish your Play-Doh into and bring it back out, and somebody's going to be like, hey, man, that looks great. He mm-hmm. knows that exists, and he's choosing not to do it in place of actually producing a piece of art, mm-hmm. you know, something that's expressing how he feels, not something fine-tuned to succeed, quote-unquote, you know, to sell records. He's relying on the authenticity to do that for him. And I, you know, I wonder if he would really care all that much if it didn't do well. Maybe it would. I don't know. It's probably a question that can't be answered because he has had success. But I think he'd keep doing what he was doing. He just seems like that type of person.
He seems like a guy who is very scared of being a particular way. Mm-hmm. And I think one of those ways is obviously seen in the track. What is it? You wanted a hit.
Oh, yeah. I think that talks exactly what we were just talking about. You wanted a hit. It's talking about how he could cater to the music industry and to the fans who, or to fans of music, not necessarily his fans, and say, you know, oh, we want a hit, and give them that because he knows how to do that. And he's saying, I am making hits. It's just not what you call a hit. I make hits all the time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put a song out if I didn't believe in it, back it.
Yeah. I think in this track, he really shows off his ability to have a Bob Dylan-esque delivery where he sounds ironic and sincere at the same time simultaneously. I think what's weird is that when I first listened to this song, the first few lines sounded kind of ironic to me or sarcastic in a certain way. But, you know, on the second listen, it actually seems like he's being the most matter of fact in the song. In the first, he says, you wanted a hit, but maybe you don't do hits. I try and I try, and it ends up feeling kind of wrong. He's saying that when he tries to go out and set out to make a hit, to make a track that would be a guaranteed hit, like some tracks are like Viva La Vida and Stacey's Mom. Like these songs, the artists knew this was going to be a hit for decades. But he's just saying it feels kind of fraudulent, which is, you know, a very Dave Foster Wallace thing to say. And I don't really know what the extent of the influence Dave Foster Wallace had on his work and his way of thinking, but I would have to assume it's quite a bit. Because, he thought of himself as a sort of abstract rival, because he was 27 when he was 31, Dave Foster Wallace, and he killed himself in 2008. So he was eliminated pretty quickly from the realm of, like, you know, what else is he going to do now? But this song is very telling because he's just saying what he feels. Whereas the other songs have a twist of poetry in them. What do you think was your favorite track on the album?
So I knew Dance Yourself Clean beforehand, and that's one of the more approachable records on the track, and I think that's why it's done better than the others in terms of streams and popularity. Relatively, it's one of their, I think it's their most viewed YouTube video, and it's their most streamed song on Spotify. And that one I knew, and I've liked. The build-up's great. It kind of works, you know, really well driving a car or in, like, a club or whatever. But anyway, great build-up and great drop and more accessible. But excluding that one because I knew it before, I really liked the last song. I really liked Home on the album. It closed it out nicely. It was still a relatively comfortable listen. And yeah, it was just nice production, but still unique. What about you? You got a favorite song from the album?
I mean, I can definitely say what are not my favorite tracks. Mm-hmm. I don't think Pow Pow is up there. I think Pow Pow is a little bit, I mean, it's a cool idea. I Can Change is pretty good. You Want a Hit is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to pick my favorite, I'll probably say either All I Want or Home. I Can Change is really good. I Can Change is a fantastic single.
It always makes me think of Bittersweet Symphony by The Verve, just because of those few lines that they have in that song.
Yeah.
I've gotten them confused a few times this week. But yeah, no.
So Pitchfork loves this album.
Yeah, no, they rated it like
9.2.
Yeah.
Which is a lot higher than a lot of the songs, a lot of the albums that are comparable of this echelon got. And they
put it the second best album of 2010. Pitchfork rated it.
Yeah, that's a pretty high accolade, I would say. They said, quote, Murphy is remaking essential 70s art rock in his own hypermodern, self-aware image, which I think is we talk a lot about on the show about how certain modern artists are finding new ways to carry the torch of traditional music styles like R&B and folk music in Phoebe Bridgers' case, and soul in Leon Bridges. And I think that we've done Kendrick Lamar and now City Sound System. I feel like those two artists are the most original in terms of the list of artists that we've covered so far. But as Pitchfork says here, and I agree, even LCD Sound System takes inspiration from a lot of like tribunal forms of art. And in this case, I mean, James Murphy has an encyclopedic knowledge of music.
He
shows it off in Losing My Edge. This guy's discography is insane. He was a DJ for a long time, and he still is a DJ, which means that he probably is the music star. Let's move on from rock star to music star, which sounds more appropriate for some reason. He's probably the music star with the most knowledge and eclectic accumulation of musical knowledge and different artists and different songs and all different kinds of styles than anyone that I've ever, you know, seen that show that off. I'm sure that a lot of people do, but he really showed it off in Losing My Edge. The Rolling Stones did a article or a story called The New Mortals.
The Rolling Stones did an article?
No, the Rolling Stone Mag.
I was like, most of them are, yeah.
Rolling Stone
not
Mag.
Not in position to do such. Anyway, yeah, sorry.
They had a article called The New Mortals, and there were 14 artists on the list, including Kanye, The Strokes, and Arcade Fire, and LCD Sound System was one of them. 14 cool. of them. And the New Mortals basically, you know, it means that modern artists that are still alive and still making music that are going to be immortal in terms of the musical cacophony.
Yeah.
And, you know, going into the future.
What they provided modern music, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's cool to see that it's mostly people who follow their own path that received that accolade. You know, I don't know much about Arcade Fire, and Kanye rubs me the wrong way sometimes, but I don't think you could argue with the fact that he
will persevere.
Yeah,
in relevance,
and he's got a plan, and he's gonna stick to it, and no matter who gets in his way. So yeah, that's cool.
So the track All I Want is Murphy's attempt to play guitar more,
mm-hmm.
in quotes, and the drums are more muted in that song. It's very reverb heavy and a little bit repetitive for my taste because he's trying to make a rock song, like a Bowie or prog, you know, esque rock song. And the instrumentation translate at about an 85% successful conversion rate, in my opinion, from Murphy's talent at producing motion heavy, like dance music, right? Electronic instrumentation. It translates, I think, about like 85% as much into the kind of music he's trying to make in All I Want, where he's playing the guitar. He's the one playing the guitar. He usually doesn't play guitar on his tracks that he writes, which I think is pretty good. I mean, I think it's got a nice guitar part on it. It's actually the first song that he wrote for the album.
Oh, really?
What do you think about that one?
Yeah, no, I definitely noticed a little bit of a shift in the sound of All I Want compared to some of the others, specifically like Drunk Girls and stuff, which has that repetitive, like almost trancey vibe to it. And then that one caught me a little off guard.
Drunk Girls?
Yeah, Drunk Girls, a little off guard at first, and it's kind of an obnoxious listen if you don't listen to the lyrics. If you listen to the lyrics surface level, you know, just him repeating "drunk girls," like it seems a little lazy, and then you realize what he's talking about, and he's kind of reflecting the culture and describing it through his basic lyricism and talking about a society of sex and obsession and abuse and addiction. And so when he gets to All I Want and he does a little more guitar, less driving in the headphones. It's a nice little change.
So about Drunk Girls, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think what happened with Drunk Girls is that in the mansion in California, Rick Rubin,
mm-hmm.
In his mansion, there were enough people there working on the album that he was friends with, so that it became like a community almost in this giant house. And he talks about on the song about drunk people trying to connect with each other, mm-hmm. and he finds that to be really hilarious mm-hmm. And predictable. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess for a writer who's very observant, and for a lyric writer too.
Yeah.
It sounds like a bad, outdated attempt at a frat anthem, which I thought was first, which I thought was the case at first, but it actually turns out to be
a critique of that culture.
I mean, I hardly think that James Murphy can be that surface level and materialistic. I don't think he's gonna write a song about.
No, he's definitely complaining about it.
Yeah. It's funny. It's a funny song.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I could see it being remediated as a frat anthem, if it just had slightly different.
Oh, it definitely could be.
Yeah, yeah.
It probably could be even knowing what it's actually about. You know?
Yeah. No, I mean absolutely. Songs do that all the time. People and audiences kind of choose what they want the song to do rather than the other way around. Like, "Hey Ya" by Outkast is about how love never lasts. And yet they play it, and everybody jumps and shouts and smiles and dances. And one of the lines is, like, they say nothing is forever, so what makes love the exception? But they sing it, you know, in a happy little tune. So I think you could definitely ignore some of the verses and some of the ad-libs that he throws into the song Drunk Girls and just be there shouting in a frat, be like, "Drunk girls, yeah, that's the point of this party."
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's actually a little bit deeper than that, and I think I mentioned earlier, his lyricism's not, it's never complex, it's always pretty accessible and easy to understand if you go and read it, or listen intently, but yeah.
I mean, I think his lyricism was a little bit more poetic in Sounds of Silver.
I'd take your word for it.
Well, in the song... You might have heard this. I don't know if you've heard this, and if you haven't, I'm going to show it to you. All My Friends.
Nope.
He writes a lot of lyrics towards the end there that are a little bit obscure and a little bit hard to understand. I don't understand what he's saying either. But he says stuff like, "You're blowing 85 days in the middle of France." "Yeah, I know it gets tired. Only where are your friends tonight? And if I'm sewn into submission, I can still come home to this. With a face like a dad and a laughable stand, you can sleep on the plane or review what you said. When you're drunk and the kids have impossible tasks, you think over and over, 'Hey, I'm finally dead.'" I don't understand what this means. I mean, this seems, it sounds good when over the instrumentation that he
I'm
has.
I'm somehow confused and I relate to what he said.
Yeah, exactly. That's good lyricism, I think, in a nutshell. At least for me, that's what I'm looking for.
I'd like to be a little less confused generally, but that applies to most of my life. I walk around not really knowing what's happening, and usually it works out all right.
Yeah. That's why genius is a thing. Mm-hmm. You like genius lyrics.
Genius lyrics are great.
It's a lifesaver.
No, yeah, we use genius a lot here on Albums Without Borders. At least
no,
I
don't.
Do.
We're original.
That's true. We've come up with this all on our own. Just it's hours sad. Of interpretation.
Yeah.
Sitting there, sober.
A lot of drugs. James Murphy looks like a teddy bear. I want to cuddle with him.
Yeah, no, he does have that like 5 o'clock shadow, and it's nice. It maybe is a little more relatable as a musician, as a person, because you see him in the making of videos on YouTube and his interviews, and he listens to his interviewer. He doesn't interrupt them. He sits there and he looks like a 35-year-old dad, 40-year-old dad. I mean, he looks pretty young considering he's 50.
Yeah.
But he definitely doesn't have a Chris Evans workout that he does every morning and a dietitian and whatever. He's just observing the world and putting his interpretations to techno beats, a little techno beats with some rock in there, and he does a pretty cool job of it. So if you have not listened to LCD Sound System, check them out.
They're like Talking Heads, but they're so not Talking Heads.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
They are compared to Talking Heads a lot. I saw that this week when I was looking them up. And he cites Talking Heads as a huge influence on his sound. But yeah, if you haven't listened to it, go check out James Murphy's LCD Sound System.
Yeah. LCD Sound System, a band where electronic musicians say they're rock music and rock musicians say they're electronic music.
Yeah.
They're the unadopted puppy They're the last ones standing. Mm-hmm. You know, no one wants to take them or adopt them as their own. They're just their own thing. They're doing their own thing.
They are indeed.
Yeah.
And somebody will come along and pick them up, and they'll be like, wow, how did nobody tell me about this? This is a great puppy.
The Steve Jobs of bands.
And there you go. All right. So we will work on some content for you guys for next episode. And thanks for tuning in.
We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
For any listeners just joining us, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Next up, what are you up to? Enjoy. Welcome to What Are You Up To? I'm your host, Kira Roddy, and today I have Tatum Staub with me in the studio. How are you?
Hi, Kira. It's so weird to be on this end of the interview.
Yeah. Normally, Tatum is the one who hosts It's Written in the Stars, and I'm the one who's kind of just like there. Now it's the opposite.
We're doing a switcheroo here.
Nice little role reversal.
I love that.
So, do you want to talk a little bit about one of the classes that you're taking or, you know, maybe a club that you're doing this semester or something like that?
Sure. So I'm taking Intro to Video Productions.
I'm actually in this class
with
Tatum.
Yes, Kira is in my class, so she's going to know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not going to talk about the class itself. But right now we're working on our final. And our final is basically like a short film, like 4 minutes, about like essentially whatever we want, I guess. So I did filming for that and I'm editing.
So can you tell us a little bit about what the filming process was like?
So basically, first of all, I had to like come up with my idea, which I did, very spur of the moment, last minute, if one could say.
Those are always the best ideas anyways.
Exactly. So I came up with that idea. Basically the idea is, these two people are like in the library or in a room, classroom, whatever, and they're breaking up and they get trapped in the room. Super exciting, super fun. So I came up with the idea, got greenlit by my professor, and I wrote a screenplay for it. Unfortunately, I had to cut like a lot of the screenplay because it could only be 4 minutes. And there was like a lot that I was trying to achieve within that 4 minutes that I couldn't, unfortunately. So, yeah, and I love screenwriting, so that was fun for me. And my partner did, like, the storyboard. I hate storyboards. I gotta be honest. I really hate them. I hate drawing.
For those of us who don't know, can you tell us what a storyboard is?
Yeah, so a storyboard is basically where you have, like, a bunch of squares on a paper, and you write down every single shot that's gonna be in a screenplay or in a scene, basically. You draw it, and that's why I hate it, because I hate drawing. And then you have to like write kind of like a little bit of what they say or what happens, because you have to have all your shots ready. And what happened was my partner and I didn't use the storyboard when we went into filming. But before I get to that, sorry, there's a lot of pieces that go into this. I had to get my actors, two actors.
And how did you find them?
So I am an actors club.
If you listen to earlier episodes of What Are You Up To, we actually had Isaac Bates on the show talking about Actors Club. So if you want to go back and listen to that, you'll know all about it.
Yeah, come join us. So I'm in Actors Club. So I know I have some actor friends. And I already kind of had like people in mind for it that I was going to ask that are like, that I'm, you know, friends with. And I know their acting ability and I know like they would be down with it. Because some people just do Actors Club for fun, while other people, like, actually want to be actors, and they could use, you know, things like this on their, like, resume or in their portfolio. So I asked two of my friends. They were immediately down. So I just had to send them the screenplay, and I was kind of just, like, memorize it or don't. Like, we'll figure it out when we get to the production process. And then I had to like check out all the stuff for it. And basically the first day of filming, we didn't get anything done, like nothing done. Like I had booked a room for like 3 hours. We got nothing done. Like, because I think my partner and I weren't using the storyboard and we didn't go through all the shots that we wanted. So we were kind of like going in blind almost. And that was the thing that I learned, that you need to like
stick to the storyboard.
Yes. Like the storyboard is very important. So the next day before our shooting time, my partner and I went through the entire screenplay and we talked about every single shot that we wanted, everything that we basically talked about what we wanted the entire thing to look like. And it took us like a few hours. And it really helped because when it came to shooting time, we got a lot more done than we did the day before.
Right.
And it just felt so much better because I could actually like direct and tell my actors their lines, knowing like what angle we were shooting at and like what it was going to look like.
Yeah, you could like visualize the end product.
Exactly.
While you're in the process of doing it.
Which helped a lot. And also like it was really fun. I don't know. Like I love directing. I think I don't necessarily want to be a director. If the opportunity arises, I would love to, but that's not like my end goal exactly. Cause it's not, I don't want to say unrealistic cause that's mean to people that want to be directors, but it's a hard
industry to break into.
Yeah, very hard. And especially if you want to be the big boss person on set, which is the director. So I do love directing though. It's really fun. And like everyone, like the actors were my friends and, you know, we were all having a good time. Like, and looking back, cause I'm in the editing process, post-production process, if you will. And
throwing in a little vocab.
Yep. And it's just so like, I was, cause I have to like look at all, there's so many fucking clips that we took, like so many, but I have to look at all of them to like decide which ones I'm going to put into, you know, the editing thing and like actually edit and cut it together. So I've just been like watching, clips that we took, and it's so like, I was just laughing for hours watching these clips because it's just like, you know, we'd mess up or like they would say something funny or like we were just like fucking around, and like it's so and it just makes me so happy to like watch it back again and be like, oh my god, I did have like such a good time like during those like little shooting days.
Are you gonna make a blooper reel?
Honestly, that would be so fun. Like, we have some really funny moments. I would not be opposed to doing that because I'm literally like, I'm downloading like clips that I'm not even gonna use just because I think they're so funny.
Yeah. So what equipment did you use for filming?
Okay, so we wanted to use two cameras, but our professor said no. So we used one handheld like camera. Mm-hmm. Then we had our annoying tripod, you know.
Yeah.
You know the struggle of the fucking tripods.
The tripods are great because they give you such like a balanced camera.
Yeah.
And if you're doing pans or anything like that, it works really well. But at the same time,
whenever
you want to change angles or just the height, oh my gosh, it's just like so repetitive.
Changing
the height on those things. What about for your mic setup?
Yeah, so we wanted the sound quality to be really great, obviously, because dialogue was very important in my film. So we had, like, the microphone, and then we had the, like, recorder, and then we had all the wires because we needed to plug that into the camera because I was not going to go in post-production and lay
sync
over
up.
The fucking, yeah, and sync up the sound. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not an editor. It's not my forte.
Syncing up external audio
is
with...
I can't even imagine.
With the video? Oh, my gosh.
No, like, and I already had, like, so we had that. We had the recorder. And then we also had this, like, really long boom, which, like, holds the mic up. Which, oh, my God, I'm, like, looking back. When I was looking back at the videos last night, I realized, because I was in charge of holding the boom mic because I was the director and my partner was the camera person. Literally, there's so many fucking clips where the boom mic just appears and I'm so mad at myself. Like, I really fucked up the sound. Like, I'm not a sound. I should not be a sound engineer because, first of all, the boom mic was in the way. I sent you a video last night, Kira. You saw it. Like, it was like this fucking 2-minute clip and the boom mic was in it the whole time. And the fact that also my partner didn't notice it is like hilarious to me. But yeah, so that happened. And then also the recorder, because basically the mic picks up the sound, goes through the recorder, and then it goes to the camera. The recorder died, or it would turn off randomly, or it would just like die.
No.
And so we have some like really good shots. The acting's great. Everything's perfect, but there's no sound. There's no fucking sound because I didn't notice that the recorder stopped. And then we would do it, but like we did a bunch of takes of this one thing, and then we noticed the fucking recorder was off. I was like, I can't.
That's
like
painful.
I'm quitting. Like.
That's
so
really painful.
It's so painful because then I'm like, okay, well, I have to use this clip because it's the only one that we have. However, am I going to have to like dub it over with my actors' voices? Like, yeah. I don't even know.
And so you were talking about editing a little bit. What platform do you use?
I use, is it Premiere Cut Pro or Premiere Cut?
Adobe Premiere Pro. You use Adobe Premiere Pro.
Yeah, that. Thank you. No, you guys, it's my first time using it. Basically, we got it for free through this class, and it's my first time ever using it. And like, I like told my brother about it because my brother is actually an editor, and I was telling him, I was like, pray for me, and he was like, oh, baby's first time using Premiere Pro, and I was like, yes, please help.
Okay,
it's so
confusing. There are so many buttons on there though.
It's so
if you don't know what
scary.
You're doing, like, you're gonna be lost.
No, like, it's very scary because, like, I did it for my last little film, but it was like I didn't have any sound in it and I just had to like cut the clips together. Like, it wasn't that bad, but like this time I'm like, oh shit, because I'm not tech savvy, I'm not good at editing things. Like, I can't, like, the TikTok videos that I make, those take it out of me. Like, I'm exhausted after I do that. Like, I'm genuinely like, I can never do that. Like, that's why I haven't done it in so long, because it's so hard. Like, editing is so hard for me. It's fun and I like it, but also I'm like, oh my god, it's exhausting.
Yeah,
so I feel like I'm a newbie.
I feel like whatever you have at the end though, like, this is why I like editing, because it's so precise, it takes so long, but at the end you get to look back at it and it's just like,
look back at
perfect
it. Yeah, like, and it's, and you're just, you just feel so proud, and yeah. You watch it over and over and over again because you're like, it's so perfect, it's my baby.
So how do you think this course is going to fit into like your overall knowledge as a film major? Like, how is it, what are you taking away?
I think I honestly, like, as much as this class has pained me, this, because there's been some things happening in this class that have not been ideal, but honestly, like, I've learned so much just because you were in this class, we're kind of just thrown into like making a video and like doing your own thing and editing and stuff. And I think that's really helped me because I've never actually been able to do something like this. Like, I am a film major, but I am a baby film major. Like, I don't know anything about film. Like, don't ask me about movies. I wouldn't be able to tell you. So I've just learned so much because I've never been able to like use equipment or like edit on like a professional editing thing that isn't iMovie, or like work with actors. Like, I've never, and like direct, I've never been able to do that because, well, okay, I've been able to do it, but like in like my spare time, but like I've never been able to do that as like an actual film major with like an actual purpose of getting this on my portfolio and things like that. So I think also, I think it's just been really important to me to know all this, because I am like, I want to be well-rounded. I want to know how to do everything in the film industry before I go into like a specific like path. And so like being able to do basically everything, like, you know, pre-production, production, post-production, like everything has been, I've like learned so much, and it's going to be really useful to me in the future because now I know like the equipment that I need and like how long editing takes, or like now I know that you actually need to like know what the shots, every single shot needs to look like. I did not know that before, and now I know that it's very important because a whole day could be wasted if you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I think like you're taking this class as a film major. I'm taking this class for a bit of like different reasons. I'm a journalism major, and so I'm taking it really essentially for more of like the hard skills, like editing, how to use Premiere Pro, how to set up like a typical interview interview shot.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not like too concerned about like the writing of a script per se, or, you know, the artisticness of my videos at the end. Like, I'm not going to be adding anything I create in this class to a portfolio. So I think that adds like another interesting level to this class where we're learning about both the production side of it, but also like how to keep your viewers involved in a story. Like you're working on a fiction film right now. So the storyline has to be intriguing. The shots need to be beautiful. Whereas I, from like kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, just want it to be straightforward. I want to know how to properly light an interview.
That's really interesting. I really love that point that you're making because it shows like when you take classes, because you can take any class that you want, but when you take classes from a certain, you know, point of view or perspective, you're taking it as from the point of view of a journalist. I'm taking it from the point of view as a film student. It's just like you get like very different things out of the class. Like exactly what you said, like I need to focus on, you know, the story and like keeping people involved and like basic, like establishing the aesthetics or establishing a shot that works with the story and like portrays a certain emotion. And yeah, yours is, you know, you want to get the information across and you want it to be clear. And that's like exactly what like a journalism student should be focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you have the pretentious film student over here. I'm like, oh, is the shot working? Is the emotion being conveyed properly?
But thanks so much for coming on. What are you up to? Do you have any last things you want to add?
I don't think so. I think I've talked a lot. I'll stop now. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a good night. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to AUP Radio's 30th episode of the semester. To any Americans out there listening, happy Thanksgiving. If you'd like to hear more, you can tune in here on World Radio Paris every day, Monday through Thursday, from 9 to 10 p.m. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or even an idea for a show that you'd like to hear us do, you can DM us on Instagram. We're at AUP Radio. This episode was produced by Nicole DeSante, Clark Marchese, and myself, your host, Kira Roddy. Music by Vicate Studios. Enjoy your night.